franchise as other Canadian citizens in elections. And these, among other reasons, are why the Métis people did not enter into the treaties, but rather took the cash offering. Okay, now the current situation today, I would say that after the script process was finished, the Métis people were never really organized as a group. We tend to be very individualistic in nature. And after the script process was completed, life carried on as normal. We had our cash and spent it, and life went on. But then in the late 60s, we've seen other Native people beginning organizing around the issue of land claims. And so we began examining our own situation. And in 1972, we formed the Métis Association of the Northwest Territories, which was followed by the establishment of a joint working relationship with the Dene Nation in 1974. We held what we would call a joint assembly with the Dene people in Fort Good Hope, and decided to begin working together towards the establishment of a claim that would cover both groups of people. And then came the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline, which caused a certain amount of disagreement between the two organizations. And in fact, the Métis Association to some extent supported the construction of the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline, and because of that there developed a very serious rift between the Métis Association and the Dene Nation. And that is historical fact. I was president of the association at that time. In fact, my tenure practically coincided with Mr. Justice Berger's commission in the territories. Okay, and as a result of that, as Bill explained, the Government of Canada had taken the position that they would accept a claims proposal from the two groups. And in fact, in 1977, the Métis Association,
non-native people of that part of the territory, and come up with an agreement on how we're going to govern ourselves. And that is, I think, a challenge that we have, an opportunity. What has been mentioned before, earlier by a number of speakers, again, the Dene Nation has been pushing for recognition of their right to self-government for about 10, 15 years now. These things are starting to happen. We also have been pushing for years for the constitutional redesign of Canada. That is happening. The redesign of the government, or the make of a government for the Dene and for the western part of the Northwest Territories, is also in the making. And it has been mentioned earlier, but the Dene have always insisted that we have all the rights of a nation, although we have by no choice of ours been forced to live within the state of Canada. That what we retain is a little short of full sovereignty. These are ideas that are not unique to the Dene, but are recognized in international law. And what we are using in supporting the political redesign of government for the Dene and for the western part of the Northwest Territories is the Dene Nation's right to self-government. That is what we are going into this process with. And that we are not giving up that right and going into a process where we are asking the federal government of Canada to give us government or to give us powers and jurisdiction that they have so that we can have a government. And our attitude is that if we do that, then we, without saying so, give up that right forever. That we have to maintain at all times that what we are doing is simply getting recognition for our right to self-government. And that is where it fits into the Canadian Constitution. So we get that at the national level, and then at the regional level, we try to come up with a political agreement between all the people in the Western Arctic and come up with a political agreement on what type of a government we're going to have, what type of jurisdiction it's going to have, how it's going to make decisions. So that's two areas of work that the Dene have been involved in, are presently involved in. The other specific area which has been also taking up a lot of our time and attention over the years with very little actual progress as far as the government is, the federal government is concerned, is in the area of what you call a comprehensive land claims agreement.
To probably every delegate from any Indigenous group here, what are they doing about looking into the incorporations, and are there any bodies set up so that maybe we can swap information on that to find out exactly what the corporations that are desecrating our country, killing our people, are doing here in your countries?
It's a good, an interesting suggestion. Don Mitchell, you have a question?
Thank you. And I guess it's for the whole panel or just whoever feels inspired to respond. One of the things I've tried to sort of keep an eye on, the evolution of your claims effort from over here with varying degrees of success, and one of the things I was struck with this morning was someone's reference to the metaphor about putting rights in a box or whether or not the box is full to begin with. And one of the things that I think is happening in Alaska, and I guess the reason for this commission, is that there are a significant number of folks who would like to get the United States government in some fashion back to the table to discuss the configuration of the deal that was cut back in 1971. And although my views shift on it all the time, my current theory is that, at least in the 20th century, there's really no such thing as negotiation, and really what happens is that the aspirations of capital becomes trapped by the Western intellectual tradition. And eventually, when the aspirations of that capital hits a certain critical mass, then the folks in charge of how things work have got to figure out what to do about that. And certainly in the 19th century in this country, what people did about that was shoot folks or move them off or do what needed to be done. And the Western intellectual tradition had evolved to a point so that in 1971 that wasn't acceptable. So people had to be cashed out. But I don't really think that you could describe that as a negotiation. But certainly because Charlie and some folks were able to trap that accumulation of capital, some deal of some fashion had to be cut. And one of the concerns I have about trying to go back and redo it is how you can recreate that kind of situation where you can at least play a couple of hands around the table sort of way out on the edge. And the thing that has always struck me, again, not knowing anything about really the details of your aspirations over there, is I've not been aware that there's really been the push of the native, of the pipeline like we had in Alaska, or the dams in James Bay, that really gave the oomph to have those people have to sit down and deal you folks out and have to be able to look at themselves in the mirror. So I guess my first question is whether or not my current assessment of the situation is correct, and it's always subject to change. And second is, if it is correct, then do you really think you're going to have the kind of luck that you're going to have? And if you really do think that that's going to be the case, then I think there might be some lessons from the techniques that you're using that would help folks here to be able to go back in and take another bite out of the apple. Or maybe we're just, maybe this is pie in the sky and maybe it's not a realistic expectation.
Commons until Aboriginal rights was restored to the Constitution. We demanded and got a meeting with the Prime Minister, and I think our Assembly, by that fairly dramatic action, can take some credit for the reinstatement of Aboriginal rights in the Constitution, along with our MP and many others who worked in the cause. Mr. Chairman, this is not to say that there is not profound dissatisfaction with the government of the Northwest Territories as it's presently structured. This is an area one-third the size of Canada. It's an area that includes peoples and histories that are vastly different, and we believe contain such diversity as to be really ungovernable. It is particularly absurd that the Northwest Territory, to us, from the Eastern Arctic, that the Northwest Territory should be governed from a capital in a southwestern portion of this vast area, three time zones away and light years away in understanding and experience in the views of many of our people. However, we believe that the model of a territorial form of government is a good base for negotiating a new government in the eastern part of the Northwest Territories. We are confident that with Nunavut, we can profit from the powers and even from the advances in recent years made by the government of the Northwest Territories in expanding its jurisdiction. And I'd just like to, by making reference to the annual report index, just list the powers that are presently enjoyed by the territorial form of government, and I think they're not insignificant, at least as a start. Justice, status of women, finance, personnel, economic development and tourism, public works, renewable resources, that includes all the land, jurisdiction over all the land mammals in the Northwest Territories, energy, mines and resources, although we don't have nearly the powers that we'd like to have in that area yet. Education, same jurisdiction as a province. Social services, health, local government, and Aboriginal rights and constitutional development. I'd also like to dispel the idea that the territorial form of government is a puppet of the federal government, which is really run by a federally appointed commissioner. Although we have a titular head of government in this person who's called the commissioner, in my view, the commissioner of the Northwest Territories, and probably with his full support, is merely a few steps away from being a lieutenant governor or a truly symbolic titular federal representative in the territories. We have very determinedly and I think successfully eroded the powers of the federal government through the commissioner over the Northwest Territories in recent years. Just last fall, we succeeded in getting the federal government to agree to eliminate the deputy commissioner's position.
Covered all the management areas, and I'll go through them briefly, and a number of kind of smaller miscellaneous topics, but also fit into the whole land management package. We decided that there had to be a land use planning process, and that there had to be a planning office with plans developed for the whole of the Nunavut region. The planning office would receive applications from developers and would, based on what was designed for the planning in the area, make a decision as to whether this project was appropriate or not. If it was seen to be appropriate, it would go forward to an impact review process. That process would hold public hearings, would review the project, and depending on what the developer's intentions were, and the kinds of terms and conditions that the developer would be prepared to live with, this board would be able to reject or modify or accept a project as it stood. We also thought it would be useful that developers negotiate what we called Inuit impact and benefit agreements as part of any term and condition of development going ahead. And this includes such things as national parks as well as mega projects, oil and gas and mining. We also realized that we had to get economic benefits in other areas within the whole land and resource package. And we designed a management body which we called the Nunavut Lands Authority. It's basically an administrative body that hands out leases and licenses to developers and collects the economic rent, which is to be split amongst both levels of government, the Nunavut government, the federal government, and the Inuit. We haven't discussed that at the table yet, so it's unclear as to where we will go with that. Other parts of the land and resource package included a water management board, water management system. We realized that you can't own water, but you can have certain rights when it comes to water, rights to clean water, rights to free running water, access to water, the ability to take resources from that water. So we decided that that was the approach we had to take. So we set up a water board and gave Inuit those kinds of rights. We haven't negotiated that part of the package yet either, so things take a while to come. We also negotiated topics on national parks, on conservation areas, archaeological sites, outpost camps, and municipal lands. In deference to the Australians' concerns this morning on cultural aspects, one of the major intentions of our archaeological package was to ensure there is a protection of archaeological sites, that Inuit be involved in any kind of excavation of it, and that artifacts that are currently not within Nunavut be returned to Nunavut. We're still at loggerheads as to who actually owns the artifacts. The federal government will not concede that they belong to Inuit, but that they are a part of the national collection for all Canadians. We also did the same thing with ethnography. When it came down to the actual identification of lands that people were interested in, we tried to, well, the federal government tried to constrain us with a number of principles. It was about a 10-page package of the do's and don'ts of land identification. These were not acceptable to us. And we said to them that, okay, before we talk about these principles that you're so interested in, we want to talk about the purpose of land identification. What is the primary purpose for Inuit to own land? And we got the federal government to agree that the primary purpose is economic self-sufficiency. And with that purpose, we were able to negotiate other principles behind it, which said that if the primary purpose is economic self-sufficiency, in order to meet that goal, Inuit have to be able to own lands for reasons of subsurface or mineral value, of renewable resource value, of commercial or industrial value, of conservation value, of areas that were important to people for spiritual and cultural reasons. So we established that those basic purposes of owning land, and then boiled down the federal document to about a page and a half of principles, which certainly doesn't give us everything that we want, but it gives us the flexibility to be able to negotiate with government for areas that do have subsurface value or areas that are currently held by third-party interests, a whole range of issues. So we try to provide some flexibility. We're not, the previous settlements have kind of given people a lump sum of land, at least that's my understanding, that you kind of settle on how much land is the federal government's prepared to turn over, and then you kind of carve it up amongst all the communities. In our case, that's not appropriate, nor is it really possible. I think using the parameters of these purposes and principles that communities on a case-by-case basis should identify lands that meet their economic self-sufficiency over time. And at the end of the day, you add up the mileage from all the communities and all the regions, and that becomes your sum total. But we haven't negotiated the process that is required to carry this through. We have negotiated municipal lands, and the primary purpose for negotiating that was to give the municipalities, as municipalities, control over the backyard. And the way it stands now is the municipalities will have jurisdiction over wide areas. They will identify the areas in which they need. And these areas shall be identified in such a fashion as to meet their long-term needs of growth. In other words, they have water, quarry rights, or recreation, they can select lands for recreational needs, municipal services, expansion of the community, and so on. There's another part of the land and resource picture that unfortunately has been lost in other areas, and I think part of it is a perception that land claims involves only land. In the case of the Inuit, the offshore is absolutely critical. All but one community in our area is located on the coast. And people, I think, derive as much, if not more, benefits, more resources from the sea than from the land areas. The federal government really doesn't have a policy on offshore claims when it comes to dealing with Inuit. If there's any policy at all, its policy is that it's not on. The federal government has recognized that we do have some rights when it comes to wildlife in offshore areas, but we don't think that that goes far enough. We think that we have rights and interests over seabed resources, over ice areas, and that we intend to negotiate these. And in fact, in all our agreements to date that have any relation to the offshore, such as planning or impact review or whatever, we always flag it that this is not to prejudice future discussions in offshore talks. There could be, our offshore package hasn't been fully put together yet, and I suspect a lot of it will turn on how successful we are in negotiating management responsibilities over land. If the mechanisms, the management structures, and so on are satisfactory to meet our needs on lands, then perhaps it's just a matter of extending those into offshore areas. If they're not particularly satisfactory or appropriate, then we may have to look at other means of handling our offshore areas. When it comes to the economic package, we kind of have an approach that says you get it where you can, that we have to be able to receive economic benefits from many, many areas, and these benefits have to come in over time. I think the federal government views the compensation package as something that is finite, and once it's been handed out, there shouldn't be really any more monies coming in. The federal government isn't happy with the notion of royalties, and if they were to negotiate royalties with us, they'd make sure that the royalties were capped. We've tried to cover our economic needs through a number of ways. Certainly, land is an important economic asset, as are renewable resources. In areas where we can get subsurface resources, that is a tremendous economic benefit. We're looking at negotiating special employment programs for Inuit involvement in the federal and territorial governments as a means of securing economic benefits. We've tried to and have been successful in negotiating Inuit impact and benefit agreements as it relates to development, when it comes to establishment of conservation areas, national parks. When it comes to negotiating these things with outside developers, we're at loggerheads with the federal government right now, because the federal government does not want independent arbitration when it comes to settling some kind of dispute between a developer and an Inuit organization negotiating these packages. The federal government believes that the minister should have the responsibility. We're not prepared to accept that. And an area that we're just starting to look at is how do we tap into federal programs in a more comprehensive fashion, and how do we mix these things with our compensation monies. Right now, the federal and territorial governments sit down and negotiate economic development agreements and subsidiary agreements and so on, but there are no positions on the Policy Advisory Committee, for instance, for Inuit to sit there and help form economic policy. There are no positions for Inuit on the management committees that review proposals for people. We're looking at ways of trying to get people into that system so they can help develop a stronger economic future, one that's more appropriate for the North, and looking at ways of how we can integrate those with monies and economic benefits that are coming in over time. The other area is the social provisions. They are probably the most important aspect of the package. They pale in comparison when you talk about billions of dollars in development and so on. They kind of get lost in the shuffle, but it's an absolutely critical area because these are the things that really come down to people at the communities, the major concerns such as housing and health and education and language. Language, I should mention that one way we're ensuring that people's language rights are looked after is that we make Inuktitut, along with the other official languages of Canada, as the languages of the business of the boards that we're establishing. So these boards are going to have to operate in Inuktitut, and the minutes, everything will be done within the Inuit language as well as English and French. We're looking at these areas now. We haven't completed the research on it, so there's not a great deal I can say about it. There are some other areas that have to be negotiated, such as eligibility and enrollment, processes of land identification, the ratification process, taxation. Taxation is something we're quite concerned about. I understand the Alaskans may have to give up large areas of land in 1991 as a result of taxation laws and not being able to hold on to it. And we're also looking at corporate structures. At this point in time, I should back up a step and say that we do have a development corporation, which is a profit-making corporation. It was set up to take advantage of business opportunities, and to handle the land claims money when it comes out of the settlement. Right now, there are other elements in the organization that are questioning following that route and trying to explore new ideas to see whether there are other appropriate models that would perhaps better meet people's interests. And I guess I won't take any more of your time, Mr. Chairman. That's basically, in a nutshell, what we've...
Mandate. It is not a negotiated settlement. It was lobbied by the forces of a body who is easily influenced by something else. And because of that, it is open for amendments. Nothing in Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act is sacred. And so Congress was even unsure of itself, of its monster that it had created, for the simple fact that they had found an opportunity for a 1985 report. So I feel that the forum and the evolution of this settlement and some of the planned disorganization of here is a settlement package in the world that had identified $1 billion without defining revenue. The village corporation and the regional corporation are still fighting who owns what. And so the subsurface estate was split up in half, and the corporate model is really devastated the cultural references of all of the native communities. And a proxy, a corporate proxy, is far less than a democracy. It only deals with bottom line. It does not deal with nobody else's rights. It sells them out. So there is no protection in corporations. But as individual tribes with sovereignty, as a member of the human phylum, we do have human rights. And it is in this context that your right in Australia, your right in Rankin Inlet, and my right in Prudhoe Bay must not be destroyed. And it is this shared commonality that we are part of the greater human effort, and we have not chose to commit suicide. And why this is important, because Congress of the United States, with the aid of some Alaskan leadership, committed